I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Midday. During his 8 years as governor, Martin O'Malley built a national reputation as a progressive leader on environmental issues. It's been a year since Republican Governor Larry Hogan has taken the helm. Has he helped Maryland keep its standing as an environmental leader? In this hour of Midday, the Chesapeake Bay Journal's Rona Cabell and Tim Wheeler catch us up on the big environmental stories of 2015 and give us a heads up on which policies affecting the Bay, clean air, and wildlife will confront the 2016 General Assembly that gets underway tomorrow. The highs and lows of Maryland environmental news and policies on Midday, after the news from NPR. Welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm very glad that you have joined us. In 24 hours, the Maryland General Assembly begins its 2016 session. Over the next couple of days here on Midday, we're going to discuss some of the issues we expect to make an impact in Annapolis this year. Today, we're zeroing in on the environment. We'll look back at some of the biggest stories in Maryland environmental news from 2015, and we'll look forward to what's on the docket for the 2016 General Assembly. During his 8 years in office, former Maryland Governor Martin O'Malley had a reputation for being tough on guns, tougher on crime, and one of the most progressive governors in regard to environmental issues. The goals of Republican Governor Larry Hogan differ significantly from O'Malley, so we'll ask this question. In the year since Governor Hogan took the reins, has Maryland kept its standing as a national environmental leader? Joining us to discuss all this is Rona Cabell, staff writer for the Chesapeake Bay Journal. For 5 years, she was the co-host and co-producer of Midday on the Bay with Dan Rodericks. Welcome back to Midday.
Thank you. Good to be here.
It's nice to see you. And Tim Wheeler, a Baltimore Sun reporter for more than 30 years, is the new managing editor and projects reporter for the Chesapeake Bay Journal. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Sheila. Glad to be here.
I'm glad you are, too. Let's begin by revisiting some of the environmental initiatives that former Governor O'Malley put into place. Tim Wheeler, what should people remember about O'Malley's
term? Well, he was promoted a wide range of environmental initiatives, things that the environmentalists generally favored. They were not happy in some respects with the pace or the degree to which he was willing to go on some of the compromises he made to get things done. But if you look back at the legislative accomplishments, they stack up from climate change all the way down to land preservation, wildlands preservation. There was a state law passed through his initiative, a three-year battle to get passed on offshore wind, to develop an offshore wind project, to subsidize it. There was a commitment to reducing greenhouse gas emissions in the state 25% by 2020. There's a commitment to energy efficiency.
Commitment to end?
Energy efficiency.
Energy efficiency.
Yeah, to promote energy efficiency and reduce energy consumption. There was increased funding for Chesapeake Bay restoration. Some of that was pretty controversial, the stormwater management fee, the rain tax, as opponents called it. He made a number of other efforts as well, but those were some of the ones that probably the signature ones.
And Rona, what would you add to the list or subtract from it?
It's a very comprehensive list. One thing that that I talk about that not that many other people talk about is Martin O'Malley made it legal to grow oysters in the state of Maryland. We now have an aquaculture industry in the state of Maryland. For 100 years, we basically didn't have one, and it was illegal to grow oysters in just about every county. Now, you could grow them for restoration, but oyster farming as a business, there were all kinds of restrictions on oyster farming, and Martin O'Malley went down to Virginia and he saw that they had an industry and wanted to know why we didn't have one. And it was said, well, because we can't. And he didn't like that answer and got a law passed in 2009 that legalized aquaculture in every county in Maryland. And now we have dozens of oyster farms and more in the pipeline. It's certainly not perfect. There's a lot of restrictions and red tape and other things. But now it is legal to raise oysters in Maryland, and there are dozens of restaurants in Baltimore where you can get a farm-raised oyster. So I think that's a victory, and I'm somewhat mystified that he doesn't ever talk about it.
Okay, he's not talking about it on the campaign trail. You're
well, there aren't many oysters. There aren't many oysters in Iowa, but I still think it's
not
it's,
that you'd want to eat.
Right. there's corn, but I think it's a significant accomplishment because for 100 years people tried to do that, and scientists at Johns Hopkins talked about how important it would be and how good it would be for the Bay and how good it would be for the economy, and nobody could get it done, and he got it done. So,
well, speaking of getting things done, I think a lot of people look back on Martin O'Malley's tenure as governor, and you know, when you're looking in the rearview mirror, what happened most recently looms bigger than what happened early in his 8 years as governor. There was kind of a mess about the pollution runoff regulations. Recap that for us, Tim.
Mm-hmm. Well, there were regulations adopted, actually a law was passed, I believe it was 2007 session, sort of midway through his term, that would require stricter controls on runoff on new development. And when the regulations came out, there was a lot of pushback from the environmental community that they were not strong enough. It went back and forth. There was some compromise. There was also pushback from the development community that basically wanted to see the regulations limited. And you know, and it wound up being a compromise that nobody was terribly happy with. The law, on the face of it, says that the runoff from a developed site should be no different, no more, and no more polluted than that from before the development started. That's the philosophy behind it. But when you get into the regulation and the weeds, things start to change. And there are a lot of whereases and wherefores in there that that cut into that a little bit. So that was one of the issues there. There, at the tail end of the O'Malley administration, there was there was a lot of trying to wrap up things that hadn't been dealt with. There was the phosphorus management or the phosphorus regulations, attempts to limit the use of chicken manure, animal manure on as farm fertilizer that bled over into the Hogan administration.
Right, and that's the one I was really thinking of, right? because what O'Malley proposed was immediately then suspended by Governor Hogan on, I think, his first day in office.
Exactly.
Which just sort of raises the question of how effective or long-lasting Governor O'Malley's impact on Maryland's environment is. I'd love for either one of you to address that. Or is it just too early to address that?
Well, I think with the phosphorus management tool, it sort of could be portrayed that Martin O'Malley tried to get it in and then Hogan stopped it. But in actuality, Martin O'Malley stopped it himself three times. And he sort of put it on the plate of Larry Hogan, who had been hearing on the campaign trail from farmers all of the reasons why this was no good. And so he stopped it, and we weren't really sure what was going to happen next. But in fact, what did happen next is he took a look at it and his people took a look at it.
You're talking about Governor Hogan.
Yes. And they put in a phosphorus management tool that was basically the same as the one that O'Malley couldn't get done in the end of his term. So,
and just take a minute to remind everyone
what
this is. Phosphorus that comes from where?
Right. So this comes from manure. So basically on the Eastern Shore, farmers are putting chicken manure on lands, and they've been doing this for decades. And some of those lands have accepted so much phosphorus that they cannot accept any more. So you put the phosphorus on the land, and it simply runs off into the creeks and rivers and streams. And when phosphorus gets into the water, it creates algae blooms that block light, and critters like crabs and small worms and such cannot live. So the idea is that you manage your phosphorus so that you're not basically just dumping it on. In areas like Iowa that don't use a lot of chicken manure, that use more calibrated fertilizer, you don't have that much that kind of a problem because you don't want to waste fertilizer because it's so expensive. But chicken manure is largely free or under a barter system on the Eastern Shore. And so without a sort of economical way to truck it out or sell it to someone else, you're left with what's a disposal problem. So the idea of the phosphorus management tool is to look at a series of metrics so that you know how much phosphorus is on your field so that you don't put more on. But what the farmers found was, well, you can't restrict how much phosphorus we can put on our fields if you don't give us a solution. We need to have some way to store it. We need to have some way to get it somewhere. And so all those details kind of needed to be worked out. And they're still being worked out, but we have, was it, I think, 8 years, Tim, before this thing actually, like, is mandated?
2022. That was one of the changes that Hogan made, was he stretched out the timeline for how this new limits would take effect. The phosphorus regulation essentially begins to put some teeth into the restriction on how much phosphorus you can put on your land, and that was, you know, sort of the gun, pointed gun that was aimed at the farmer's head, is that we have to find something to do with this stuff if we can't put it on our land. Also, the other complication is if we can't use it as fertilizer, we're going to have to buy fertilizer.
Right.
So it's sort of a double impact on the farmers. That's Tim Wheeler, projects editor, managing editor and projects reporter of the Chesapeake Bay Journal here on Midday on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. A minute ago, we heard Rona Cobell from the Bay Journal summarizing for us the phosphorus management tool and why it is needed. I'd love for you to be part of this conversation, listeners. What's your sense of how Maryland is handling the environment? Too lax? Too intrusive? About right? You can call us. Our local number is 410-662-8780. We have a toll-free line. That's 1-866-661-9309. And, of course, you can send us an email at midday@wypr.org. You have both of you teed up perfectly what I was planning to ask and will about how the Hogan administration is an overview of how they're approaching it. But before I ask you to go there, I do want to just spend a little more time, because there has been some skeptical coverage of Martin O'Malley as he campaigns for president as to whether he has a right to the environmental cred that he cites in some of his speeches. And I just wanted to get your sense, as people who've covered him for years, covered his policies on the environment, whether there's too much of a halo around Martin O'Malley on the environment.
Well, he was not beloved by farmers, and that may have been part of the problem. I mean, one reason that Hogan was able to get to go forward, or one reason he went forward without any opposition from farmers, was they said they trusted him, that he would listen to them if they were having problems complying with the new phosphorus rules, and they would give them an out or find some other way to deal with this. There wasn't that level of trust or collaboration with the farm community, with O'Malley. By the same token, there were those in the environmental community who thought he was still partial to them.
That Martin O'Malley was partial to them.
One of his law school classmates was the general counsel for Purdue. And so there was a perception there, especially because of a court case that was brought by environmental advocates against a poultry farm on the shore that was run by Purdue, and has sued Purdue as well. There was a belief that somehow that he was looking out for them. He criticized the
looking out for the farmers, for Purdue
and that whole group. And so there was a belief that he was tight with them. So there's, you know, on both sides, there was some distrust of him in that regard.
I would say that the environmentalists really liked O'Malley, but for the Purdue. I think I wrote a blog post once before, years ago, talking about how the Purdue seemed to be something of a blind spot for him. It is somewhat unusual for a sitting governor to write a letter to an independent law clinic urging them to not take a case, and to in fact suggest that someone who is accused of polluting the environment would be better served as a client of the law clinic rather than someone being prosecuted by them. And this not only rankled the environment community, but also the law community, the legal community, who felt that it cast a pall over the work that the law clinic was supposed to do. And indeed, in Louisiana, Tulane, I believe, their law clinic had been tussling with the state legislature over litigation they were doing over BP and other chemical companies. And it just kind of left a bad taste in people's mouth that this could happen in Maryland. About the halo over Martin O'Malley's head, I'm not sure there is a halo. I find that you don't hear much about his campaign at all, except whether he can get on the ballot in a state. I'm not asking
you to do a whole political analysis, but yeah. I mean, I think, well, we're going to need to take a break here. And before we do that, I would like to get you a little sense of how you see Governor Hogan in the tradition of Maryland environmental regulation. You've talked about an example where, as you described it, Rona Cabell, Governor Hogan's been able to get in place a set of regulations about fertilizer pollution that was essentially what Martin O'Malley was trying to get and didn't. In general, would you say that how would you describe Larry Hogan's first year in terms of environmental regulation and management?
Well, it's a mixed record. I mean, there's been some friction over air quality regulations. This was another issue that was a slip over from the O'Malley administration. There was a regulation that was drawn up in the final days of O'Malley's term that would have required additional cutbacks in smog-forming emissions from coal-burning power plants in Maryland. One set of plant owners was okay with it. They went back and forth. This was like the phosphorus thing in that they went back and forth trying to find some common ground. But one owner of two plants in Maryland opposed it, the ones in the Washington area, and appealed to Governor Hogan, who also pulled back that regulation. Ultimately, he proposed his own more flexible regulation that the Hogan administration contends is just as protective of Maryland's air quality. The environmentalists disagree; they're in court, but the regulation is going forward.
We do need to take a break. That's Tim Wheeler of the Chesapeake Bay Journal. Also with us is Rona Cabell of the Bay Journal. We're talking about the environment. We're going to talk more after this break about what the Hogan administration has been doing and also what we can expect the 2016 session of the General Assembly to focus on. We'd like you to participate in this conversation. What you'd like to see state government do or not do. We'd like to hear your thoughts about pollution in the Bay and other issues. You can give us a call locally, 410-662-8780, or you can send us an email at midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Cast. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Midday, everyone. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about Maryland's environment. Our guests are Rona Cabell and Tim Wheeler, both of the Bay Journal. They've both covered Maryland's environment for years. In fact, I was wondering as I was thinking of the pleasure of talking to both of you, combined how many years of Maryland environmental coverage am I sitting at the table with?
More than four decades. Would that be safe?
Wow.
Yes. Okay. I've done at least 12. And then before that, I covered toxic dumps in Anne Arundel County. So I'm never sure if I should count that.
Okay. Decades. We're talking decades of expertise.
Rona
here
isn't showing that mileage the way I do.
I have to tell you speak the truth, Tim. Rona does not show the decades of wear as much as you. But we respect you both. And I would like to remind listeners that you can take advantage of all this expertise we have here with your questions about the environment or your comments about how things are going. You can call us locally, 410-662-8780, or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. We would love to hear from you. I want to focus now on the Maryland General Assembly, which is to convene its 2016 session in about 24 hours. Rona, what changes do you expect the General Assembly to focus on? What do you think its environmental priorities will be?
I think this is going to be a big year for nutrient trading, which is something we've been hearing about recently. And nutrient trading is kind of a complicated thing where when large wastewater plants, power plants, what we call point sources, can't meet the requirements, they seek to trade to buy credits on a market and offset that. And so, say a wastewater plant would maybe trade with another wastewater plant or more likely with a farm. So they can't meet their requirements. So instead of spending millions of dollars to upgrade something in their wastewater plant, they spend a couple $1 million and they plant buffers on an Eastern Shore farm. The problem with this system is that someone loses and someone wins. And what a lot of the environmental advocates are worried about is that the people who lose will be the poor people, the people who live in the city, the people who live near the plant that can't meet its requirements. So what we're going to be looking to see in the legislature is if there's going to be any
Let me just interrupt to make sure I'm clear on the basics. Does nutrient trading already go on in Maryland?
There is a plan for nutrient trading, but there haven't been any trades. It is going on in Virginia. Pennsylvania also has a plan, but the EPA has pretty much quashed it right now. So Pennsylvania isn't trading. Virginia's trading.
And Maryland, it's not – trading is not taking place in Maryland.
Right. There haven't been any trades yet, but there's –
But there is a law. There is a state law that would – there's a structure for it.
Right.
So theoretically, the legislature would not have to take action for nutrient trading to proceed in Maryland. Question mark.
Right. I don't think they need to pass a bill, but there's probably going to be some bills around it to make sure some people who are concerned about nutrient trading might put bills in to say you have to verify your trades, or you have to make sure that there's an independent auditor for the trades, and sort of put things in legislation that they think fall short in the regulations.
Okay.
So I expect that we'll see that. Governor Hogan's very excited about nutrient trading. It's sort of a libertarian, Republican kind of thing that we let the markets fix it all. He's excited. MDE Secretary Ben Grumbles is very excited about
Maryland trading. Department of Environment.
Yes.
Is excited about it. So you think that the Hogan administration will be eager to work with the legislature on this?
I do. And I think that they're also eager to show that Maryland can do it correctly, because there isn't any state that is doing trades between point sources like wastewater plants and power plants and non-point, which is farms. North Carolina's got a program, but they're just doing it within their regulated community. So farms don't have to follow the same regulations that wastewater plants and power plants do, which is one of the reasons why we needed this phosphorus management tool. So people are very interested to see if this is A, possible, and if B, Maryland's program could be a model.
Now, when I think about pollution trading, I think first about air pollution. And that, again, Tim, I turn to you. Is that already taking place in Maryland?
Yes, there's been a sort of a long tradition of trading pollution credits, basically having one polluter pay another one to reduce their pollution because it's cheaper than that person doing it. Or the more typical case is when a new business or industry comes into an area and wants to build a plant or a factory or wants to expand, and there is already, the air is already polluted. The regulators typically say, well, you have to find an offset. If you want to do that, then you have to find an offset. Find a company that's cutting back on its pollution, or that's going out of business, or something like that, so we can dock it basically on the books and show that the amount of pollution in our air is not getting any worse, at the very least. There's the noted example where trading was used to actually reduce pollution is in the area of acid rain. So much of the rainfall had so much pollution in it, it pulled acid out of the emissions from power plants, and it drained into our lakes and our rivers. It's a particular problem in the Northeast, somewhat of a problem here also. Years ago, under federal legislation, a trading program was set up. There was essentially a cap put on how much emissions could be done that would release this acidic emissions, and that cap was lowered. And as it was lowered, power plants had to find ways to reduce their emissions, and in some cases they were paying other power plants to do what they couldn't. It was proved to be relatively effective. But it's controversial. There are those who believe that just on principle, polluters shouldn't be allowed to pay somebody else so they could continue polluting. And there is, in fact, on the area of nutrient pollution, there's a lawsuit pending by one environmental group questioning the legality of this, saying that the Clean Water Act does not specifically talk
about
trading.
Clean Water Act. Yeah. So is there anything that the Maryland General Assembly is likely to do relating to trading air pollution credits? Or is that not really before them?
I don't think that's really before them this time around. And on the nutrient trading side, I think Rona had it just right. I mean, the administration, I think, believes they've got the legal authority to go forward now. There may be some moves by the legislature to put some parameters on that. And there may be some housekeeping issues that they realize they need to do as well.
So, okay, just tell me more then about where you, Tim Wheeler, think the legislature is going to focus its environmental attention.
Okay, there are several, you know, important issues that the legislature is going to have to deal with. One of the most important ones, arguably, is climate change. The Greenhouse Gas Reduction Act that was passed under O'Malley is required under the law that they adopted to be re-upped, essentially renewed this year by the legislature. We've had about 5 years or 6 years of performance under the Greenhouse Gas Reduction Act, which requires a 25% reduction by 2020 in carbon dioxide and greenhouse gases. The State Department of the Environment has reported just recently that we appear to be on track to meet that goal. So it has not hurt Maryland's economy. That was one of the caveats to the legislature passing it, was that it had to be proof or evidence that it was actually improving, not hurting the economy. So all that signs are go on that. A climate change commission that was originally appointed by O'Malley and then made permanent last year by the legislature and approved by Hogan has recommended that they not only renew the commitment to reduce Greenhouse Gas Reduction Act, but up the ante to go for 40% reduction by 2030. I think that's the right numbers. That was recommended unanimously by this commission, which included Hogan administration appointees who all backed it. So there's a presumption that the Hogan administration is in favor of that. That will be one of the signature pieces of legislation they'll have to deal with this year. Setting a goal is fine, especially when you set a new, more ambitious goal. How you get there is the key. There'll be questions about whether this administration and the legislature are willing to require or to continue to provide subsidies through ratepayer increases for energy efficiency and for renewable energy, among other things. And the offshore wind project may be one of those things that's in the crosshairs here.
It's Tim Wheeler of the Chesapeake Bay Journal here on Midday on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. Rona Cobell of the Chesapeake Bay Journal is also with us. We're talking about Maryland's environment and what the legislature and the Hogan administration are likely to do for and to it in the coming session. We'd love you to be part of the conversation. Give us a call at 410-662-8780 or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. Owen has called us. Owen picked up on something that I think I let go by. Owen from Baltimore, welcome to Midday.
Hi, thank you very much for taking my question. So I wanted to follow up on a comment that Rhoda made regarding the toxic waste dumps in Anne Arundel County, and I wanted to find out what the status was of those and what exactly was in them.
Well, Owen, you're reminding me of my past here. I haven't looked into these things in a while, but I covered Fort Meade, which is where the Army has a base and the National Security Agency, and they were having problems with a substance called carbon tetrachloride. And they had a whole bunch of drums of chemicals, and now I can't remember what was in them, buried at Fort Meade, and Fort Meade was declared a Superfund site. So while I was in the county for 4 years as a Baltimore Sun reporter, my job was to chronicle the cleanup, which I believe is probably still going on. And one of my favorite stories was NSA wouldn't give the Army information about where the toxins were buried because it said its dirt was classified. But we ended up being able to get that information. The other place I know of where there is waste is there was a kind of an illegal dumping ground right off of Route 2, where not far from where Murph's is, if you know where that is. And it was near a historically African-American community called Cedar Morris Hills. And it was declared, I believe, a Superfund site back in the 90s. And then the third site that that I wrote quite a bit about that had a lot of pollution was the U.S. Coast Guard Yard, in right near Fort Smallwood. And I don't remember if it was actually ever officially declared a Superfund site, but there was a lot of toxins from paint stripping, from repairing boats. And this was all well before we knew any of these things were issues in after the World War II and in those years. So I hope that's helpful.
Owen, thanks for the call. Tim is calling from Chestertown with a question. Tim, welcome to Midday.
Yes, thank you. My question was if they know anything about the current situation to increase the menhaden population, the filter fish that is being overfished in the Chesapeake Bay and is a natural filter feeder, which would increase not only the clarity of the water in improving the health, but also improve, you know, other native fish populations. Tim, it's been a controversial issue for many years, but it's a very easy, free filtering fish.
Tim, thanks for the question. I wish you could see the way Rona is pointing to Tim, and Tim is sort of wincing. But because Rona pointed to Tim, I'm going to point to Tim and ask whether you can shed any light on where we are in increasing the menhaden population.
I'll do my best. Tim, nice name. I appreciate that. There were limits put on coastwide limits all up and down the East Coast by the Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission on menhaden, and a reduction in catch ordered three years ago. Time flies when you're as old as I am. But since then, there's been and there was, you know, resistance to that by the industry, which argued that there was no real shortage of menhaden and that this was all invented. A lot of environmental conservation groups out there and recreational fishermen, at least, would disagree. And there had been evidence generated by studies that indicated that there was a significant drop in menhaden abundance and reproduction. There was a new assessment made by fishery scientists, and it came back and concluded that they were more abundant than previously believed, or not as scarce as previously believed, and that there was not as much reason for concern. There's still some debate and discussion about that. It's a complicated issue, and we're talking about a whole coastwide stock, not simply what's in the Chesapeake Bay. And so the commission relaxed its limit some, but not completely. And so there's going to be probably more debate and pressure over that. The industry would like to get that cap raised even more over time. And there are still those who are concerned about the need here. It's an important issue for us here in Maryland in the Chesapeake Bay, not just for the filter feeding issue, which is, again, a matter of some debate in scientific circles, but they're a vital bait fish. For those who like to eat blue crabs, that's oftentimes the kind of bait that is used to catch crabs. Without that, might be a little harder or more expensive to get crabs in the future. So there was that sort of tension there, again, with the menhaden limits.
Tim, I appreciate the phone call. And it's time for us to take another quick break. Environmental reporters Rona Cabell and Tim Wheeler, both from the Chesapeake Bay Journal, are with us this hour. It's a great time for you to steer the conversation if you're worried about some aspect of the environment or if you've noticed something in Maryland that you think is working well on the environment. Our local number is 410-662-8780. Our toll-free long-distance number is 1-866-661-9309, and our email address is midday@wypr.org. We'd certainly love to hear from you. When we come back, I've got some things I want to tie up about what the General Assembly may be talking about. We'll also talk about some national issues, and you're welcome to join the conversation. I'm Sheila Cast. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. Our guests this hour, as we discuss the Maryland's environment and what changes may be made in regulation thereof, are Rona Cabell and Tim Wheeler, both of the Chesapeake Bay Journal. We've been talking about some recent developments in environmental regulation and what we can expect from the Maryland General Assembly this year. One issue that I understand will be back before the General Assembly. Last year, Delegate Ann Healy, Democrat of Prince George's County, sponsored the Pollinator Protection Act, which I guess was aimed at making sure bees are not hurt. Tim, explain to me what it's aimed at doing, because I'm not sure I can pronounce the chemical that is at issue here. And tell me what you expect to happen in the General Assembly this session.
Sure. There's a concern about a class of insecticides called neonicotinoids. the term
neonicotinoid.
Yes, nicotine is sort of the root word there, and yeah. it's a chemical that sort of acts sort of related to nicotine in the sense it's widely used in agriculture, and it's also used in some of the consumer products to treat you know, not only to directly spray on plants, but also to sort of treat the seeds and the plants themselves as sort of a systemic insecticide that keeps the bugs away. There's a lot of concern that there's been a drop-off since about 2008, I think, or maybe even sooner, in honeybee colonies nationwide, and certainly here in Maryland. In fact, the drop-off in Maryland sometimes has been more recently greater than in some other states and greater than the national average. And beekeepers, looking for why this may be, have felt that there was clear evidence, or there was evidence, that these pesticides played a role. The research on that has so far said that it's, you know, the scientists have said it's a factor, maybe a factor. There's also parasites and that sort of thing, and other disease factors for why bees may be dropping off. But there's evidence, just recently an EPA study came out that found that there was evidence that application of pesticide on some agricultural crops could be, in fact, inhibiting honeybees. It didn't apply to corn, which is, of course, our major ag crop here. But there's a concern that these products are in the environment, and if we can do without them, let's do it.
But the bill died in the legislature last year, legislature was not convinced.
Were not convinced. Some lawmakers had a hard time pronouncing that word, too. It was a difficult issue. It's complicated. And there was not even that EPA study at that time, so there was a lot more dispute about what the impacts were. The Hogan administration opposed it because they felt it was going to put the regulation of pesticides was going to require them to spend more money on sort of keeping tabs on all this stuff. The bill that has been put in and apparently will come back again would basically keep out of the hands of the average household consumer pesticides that the neonicotinoid pesticides. And it would require labeling of seeds and nursery plants that you buy at the home and garden store or from a nursery to plant in your garden. It would require those be labeled to say that this plant or this seed has been treated with this pesticide. So consumers could decide for themselves if they want to use it or not. And so that's likely to come back again this year. That's my understanding.
That's Tim Wheeler of the Chesapeake Bay Journal. Rona Cabell of the Chesapeake Bay Journal is also with us this hour as we discuss the environment, and you can be too. You can send us an email at midday@wypr.org, or you can phone us at 410-662-8780. James McGarry, James is calling us from Tacoma Park. James, welcome to Midday.
Yeah, hi, Sheila. Hi, Tim. Hi, Rona. Wanted to follow up on something that that Tim said about climate change legislation and how do we achieve these greenhouse gas reduction goals that are being set. And arguably one of the biggest environmental priorities and one of the biggest environmental bills that will be submitted this session is the Maryland Clean Energy Jobs Act that would increase Maryland's renewable energy standard to 25% renewable energy by 2020, which would be up from the current goals of that Maryland get 20% of its electricity from renewable sources by 2022. And this bill would reduce the carbon equivalent of about 563,000 cars off the road every year and create over 1,000 construction jobs in the solar industry every year to install the new clean energy installations. And one aspect of this bill that I just want to bring up is that it will include a $40 million jobs package to focus on workforce development and also business development to bring more minority and women-owned businesses into the clean energy sector.
James, I appreciate your telling us about the bill. Tim Wheeler, what's lining up pro and con this bill? Do you have a sense of who's for it, who's against it? Where will the Hogan administration be on this bill?
Well, that'll be a good question. The version of this bill was brought up last year and did not succeed. I believe the advocates have succeeded in getting a couple of key legislators, at least one, the House Committee Chair who oversees this bill, endorse it this year. So its prospects for at least getting to the floor and getting a vote are greater. The Hogan administration has been somewhat lukewarm to the idea of requiring ratepayers to pay more. I know when I interviewed Larry Hogan, candidate Larry Hogan, who was running for governor, that was one thing that he said was he was all in favor of solar and wind and all that other stuff, but he thought that Maryland's utility customers were already paying too much for their power, and he did not see the point of doing that. They haven't been heard on this issue so far, so that'll be interesting to see what they have to say. I mean, that is a question. If you are in favor of reducing greenhouse gases, how do you really intend to get there?
James, I appreciate the call. Thank you. Rona, obviously the environment doesn't stop at the state's edge, and so let's just talk a minute about some national or international issues. I haven't talked to either of you on Midday since the climate change conference in Paris. Is there anything from the conference that will have an impact that we'll see here in Maryland?
I think just the fact that the world got together and came up with something is going to make it harder for the rhetoric to continue that climate change isn't real and that it isn't man-made. I think I've seen a toning down of that rhetoric already. I don't know if you would agree with that, but
yeah, I think I tend to. It strikes me that way too.
And so I'm hoping that with that, we will spend less time and energy debating about the causes and more time focusing on what we can actually do about it, and less time talking about how states can't control it and, you know, it's all China's fault, and more time looking at the things that we can control. And, I mean, if the world could come together, certainly the states can come together and, you know, one state can come together.
One state.
I mean, Maryland could, you know, can do things within Maryland.
Okay.
I mean, one of the arguments that you frequently hear is, well, you know, why do we need to bother? It's a worldwide problem. Our little piece of it isn't going to matter. And I think this has shown that as long as no one was doing anything, it was okay to not do anything. But now that something's been done, I think everybody needs to step up. That's the message I take from it.
Okay. And speaking of doing things here in Maryland, Tim Wheeler, there's an idea among some legislators to put more responsibility on poultry producers to control pollution.
Two staffers for the Bay Journal couldn't get here and talk about legislation in Annapolis without talking about something related to the Bay. And this is probably one of the sort of the newer wrinkles here is that there's going to be a bill introduced that would essentially hold the poultry companies responsible for the manure generated by the birds. The way the industry works is they basically contract with farmers to grow their birds. And then once the birds reach marketable size, they're trucked away to the processing plant. Mm-hmm. The manure stays behind. As Rona explained so well before, the farmers often use it as fertilizer, but when they can't, they're stuck with it. And so that's one of the issues. And so the bill would basically require the integrators, the poultry companies, to take responsibility for trucking away the excess manure and doing something with it, you know, environmentally responsible, and sort of track it. Because right now, if it leaves the farm, you don't exactly know where it's going. A version of this has been tried in regulation way back in the Glendening administration, and it never got anywhere. Doing it through the legislature may work this time. There's certainly pressure here because of the phosphorus limits that they have to come up with a solution for this excess manure, and this is one avenue.
Well, let me ask you the same thing I ask you about air pollution. Where would the Hogan administration be on this?
That's a good question.
It's the same answer you gave me before.
Yes, we're waiting to see. That's what gives us all, you know, employment.
If I could just add something, when I spoke before about the phosphorus management tool, Larry Hogan didn't put those rules in out of the goodness of his heart. Larry Hogan put those rules in because every state in the Chesapeake Bay watershed has limits that it has to meet under the Chesapeake Bay total maximum daily load, which is our pollution diet. We need to have that phosphorus limit in place so that we can meet those rules. That's the hammer. So the chicken bill that Tim is talking about is one mechanism to make this work. It may not be the mechanism that ends up being what works, but it is one way that we're working towards meeting this load.
So you're saying everyone has to at least look at it very carefully without dismissing it.
Yeah, I mean, I was in Arkansas, which is hardly a paragon of progressive environmental regulation, and they have something called the litter bank, where they have basically a free market exchange on chicken manure, and it works really well. But they didn't do it out of the goodness of their heart either. They were sued, and they needed to come up with a solution. So I think, you know, I haven't really looked closely at this bill. Well, I don't know that it's even been introduced yet. But I think, you know, what we're talking about is a solution that we have to get to. So
I'm going to interrupt you because we have just a couple minutes left, and I want to see whether we can give Mark in Highland Town a quick answer to his question. Mark, what is your question? Welcome to the show. Mark, are you there? Well, Mark apparently wanted to ask, where are we now on runoff and smart growth? Is that something either one of you can address? Or should we save that for another?
Tim's the growth guy.
I had that beat once, along with several others. Smart growth is another thing that's a little bit in the crosshairs. It's a concept that everybody endorses, but your version of smart growth may not be mine. The Hogan administration came in promising that they were going to listen a lot more to local governments and to stakeholders, including the development community, on issues like this. I think it's environmental community is sort of braced for some pushback against the limits on development using septic systems that were put in under the O'Malley administration. We didn't talk about that. That was one of the things that O'Malley also did. And there may be some pushback on the notion that one has to use the much more expensive, less polluting septic systems throughout the state, another requirement that was put in under O'Malley. Both of those things have raised the cost of new homes. There's perception in the building community that the housing industry is still not back to where it used to be. Of course, that's maybe true nationwide, too. So there will be that kind of pressure, and rural communities have bucked against this because they do not have large communities on sewer systems the way, you know, some places on the Western Shore do.
I have just a minute left with you, and since you're both alumni of the Baltimore Sun, I want to read to you the first sentence. You've probably looked at it already from the Baltimore Sun editorial today. It's editorial about the legislature. The section on the environment begins: while Governor Hogan's first session was regarded as an unexpected triumph for environmentalists, particularly for the Chesapeake Bay, advocates once again find themselves mostly in a defensive posture, close quote. That's the Baltimore Sun's characterization of what the session will be like. From your perspective, is defensive posture the right concept to have as we watch environmental issues, environmentalist push issues in the General Assembly this session?
One could differ about whether it's mostly defensive. There's an element of defense and offense both. Obviously, the bills we were talking about, the Poultry Litter Responsibility Act, the neonicotinoid bill.
And the bees.
And that's the bees.
Yeah.
And the greenhouse gas climate change bill. Those are all things that the environmental community is going to be pushing. They're hoping that, in some of those cases, they'll have the backing of the Hogan administration. In others, they may not. On the defensive side, things like I'm talking about, like with smart growth, could be one of those issues. If there's an attempt to limit the offshore wind or to kill it this year, that would be another thing that would be a defensive issue.
I can give you 10 seconds, Rona.
What Tim said.
Okay, what Tim said. We will leave it there, and we'll ask you both to come back as this unfolds. I want to thank Rona Cabell and Tim Wheeler from the Chesapeake Bay Journal. It's been a really interesting conversation. I've learned a lot. Thanks also to Two Boots Pizza for providing lunch for our guests today. Two Boots is located at 1203 West Mount Royal Avenue, one block from the Lyric. They serve traditional and Cajun Italian pizzas. If you go to twoboots.com, that's two spelled out, T-W-O-B-O-O-T-S, you can click on the Baltimore location. And thank you for listening. I'm Sheila Cast. When Midday is back tomorrow, we'll talk more about issues before the legislature. The buzzword of the session will be budget, budget, budget. We hope you can join us for that. Have a great afternoon. I'm Sheila Cast. Here and Now is next.
Midday is produced by Maureen Harvey and Connor Graham. The show is engineered by Luke Spicknall. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming are available at WYPR.org or on demand using the WYPR app. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.